So welcome to our third class on this, I don't know, this, we're calling it a zopera. It's kind of funny, right? The good news for you guys is we have not been singing. If you had heard me singing, you would be glad that it wasn't. But we would like, maybe I'll just say a few words about kind of what has happened for those of you who've been with us, to just remind you that in class one, Ambetta was sent by his teacher to see if the Buddha lives up to his reputation. And Pokrasati, the teacher, thought, well, if the Buddha lives up to his reputation, then he'll have these 32 marks. So Ambetta goes off to see if the Buddha has the 32 marks. He doesn't even look for them, though, when Ambetta arrives. Instead, he's so distraught by the way he's treated, and he calls the Buddha and all the Sakyans riffraff. And so Ambetta thought he was like superior to everybody, and everybody else is riffraff. And then on Wednesday, the Buddha and Ambetta have a debate. And in the course of this debate, the Buddha gets Ambetta to admit that in fact he is descended from a group of people that formerly were slaves to the people that were the Buddha's people. And then the Buddha describes to Ambetta the gradual training, like how a person becomes awakened. But Ambetta ignores the discourse, doesn't even admit that it happened, but he does remember he's supposed to look for the 32 marks, sees the 32 marks, and goes back to report to his teacher. So that's a little kind of what we saw before. We'd like to open it up. Questions, comments? Do you have anything you'd like to add here? Okay, well, maybe I'll add just a little bit here. I called the interaction between the Buddha and the Ambetta a debate. And this was an established event that happened in ancient India. And there's like very particular rules about how a debate happens and what are the characteristics of it. And so we elided, we didn't include all the different elements in our dramatization, but this would have satisfied the criteria of a debate in ancient India. And it kind of makes sense, right? This was how people learned things, or how they discovered new things, or something like this, right? That it would have been like an oral culture. It makes sense that these types of events would have been commonplace and helped people to, I don't know, learn new ideas or get acquainted with different people. And I don't know if any of my co-teachers, if they have something they'd like to add.
Well, I would just pause again to ask if there are any questions. Sometimes it takes a pause for people to kind of come forth with a question. And okay, see? Steve, go ahead.
Yes, I just wonder, where are the missing topknots?
Where are they? What do you mean?
I don't have a topknot today.
Oh, right.
It's actually... I wore my hair down today. That's because today I'm just a narrator. There is no role today for the upset Brahmin student, colleague and contemporary of Ambetta's. And so... I didn't want to confuse people by wearing a topknot. I do have Ananda's ready. Thanks, Steve. Margaret.
Yeah, what are the three knowledges that they keep on mentioning throughout here? Please, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I think all four of us know this, but I'll open it up to some of my co-teachers if they want to describe or talk about the three knowledges.
Well, I can say that I actually don't know what the three Vedic knowledges are, which is what's referred to as what the Brahmins know. They're skilled in in some particular knowledges that are supposed to come through memorizing the Vedic texts. But this is one of those teachings where the Buddha co-opted it for his own, within his own structure of his teachings. And so when the Buddha refers to the three knowledges, those are very specific. They're an understanding of one's own past lives, one's long history of being reborn again and again, And then the second knowledge is to understand the workings of karma, to understand how it is that beings get reborn according to their karmic tendencies at the time of death. Is that, you know, their karma influences what realm they're reborn in, and you understand how all of that works. That's the second knowledge. And then the third knowledge is to understand what's called the destruction of the taints. So we see the ending of greed, hatred, and delusion, presumably prompted by the first two knowledges. Understanding what samsara is and how it operates is what allows the mind to become free of it. That would be my quick summary.
Thank you so much.
Okay, well, maybe David, you're unmuted. Do you have something you'd like to say?
You know, just following both what you said, Diana, and then Kim's response to Margaret's question, one thing that we haven't talked about a lot, and we have a minute or two here to just say this, which is that one thing that I think we recognize as teachers and, you know, having spent a lot of time with these texts and with the tradition, is that just the many, many ways, the myriad ways in which the Buddha relates his teachings to the mainstream teachings of his era. And we see this in, for example, three knowledges distinct to the Buddha's path of practice and the three knowledges of the Brahmins. There's this contrast, there's this constant use of language to make puns and to turn terms in different ways. In this text, for example, that we're reading, I say text, but I mean this theater, the true Brahman emerges, right? What makes for a true Brahman? And in that, he's actually flipping that concept. He flips the concepts in a lot of ways. We see this in the debate that Diana mentioned, that it's full of, we didn't get into this, but in several ways, the Buddha follows the Brahman's rules of debate, the Brahman's rhetorical techniques. And this legitimizes his approach because he's proving what he wants to prove, that birth isn't important, in their mode of debate. I'll give you one example. One of the things he does is make an argument based on etymology, on the origins of words, and we didn't describe it, but both when he links ambata to the kanhas, he's riffing on the idea that kanha means black, and so he's bringing in this story. Likewise, his clan name, Sakyan, in the texts, he relates to its reference to teak trees. So anyway, he's using etymology, he's using a Brahmin's argumentative technique or rhetorical technique to win the debate. So these texts, this tradition is full of this, and both Diana and Kim sort of in their comments make reference to that larger thing that's going on here, that everybody at the time in the text, everybody sitting present in the wood on this moonlit evening would have been aware of. That's part of their context of receiving the teachings that are held here.
Okay, so maybe I'll pass it on to Kim.
Okay, great. So as we've done before, we'll start with a short sitting together just to arrive. Get our minds prepared. So just finding a comfortable posture for meditation, allowing yourself to settle in, perhaps feeling the seat where you're sitting. So your body resting against the chair or the cushion, and feeling the stability of where you're sitting. Allowing yourself to be supported. Softening or relaxing the body. And then you may naturally find, as the body relaxes, there's a lifting of the spine. As the habitual tensions slip away, there's a response of uprightness, allowing the posture to be alert as well as relaxed. Perhaps particularly softening the eyes and the eye sockets. Looking at the screen, it's easy for the eyes to get a little tense. Softening all the little muscles around the scalp. Down into the shoulders. The arms. And softening down into the chest area, lingering for a moment in the area of the heart. Seeing how that feels right now. Down into the belly. An area where we tend to hold, just letting that be soft. And releasing any bracing in the legs or feet. Returning attention to the sense of the whole body sitting. Perhaps using either that sense or the in and out breathing to invite some ease in the mind. And even if what's happening in the mind is not particularly peaceful, there can be a sense of joy, subtle joy, just at being present for whatever is. Perhaps there's even some meditative joy arising from the relative state of ease. And allowing any sense of simple peace or pleasure to fill the body, breathe it through the body. And as we move into the last couple of minutes of this meditation, I'd like to invite a reflection to consider. Has there been a time when a single thing that someone said to you changed your perspective? Has there been a time when there was a genuine shift from hearing something that you can remember in the moment? And just rest in that potential of transformation just from hearing the words of another.
Thank you, Kim, for the grounding meditation and also that very profound question at the end. Sort of a question about the transformative potential of the hearing of the teachings. So thank you for that. Let's turn to the next readings. We have a few somewhat briefer readings, although they're really important. They're sort of the climax of the story, and maybe they're simple and short for that reason. And just to set the scene, Diana's set it up for us, but we can say this again, just that Ambutta has received a description of the Buddha's path of practice. He's seen the 32 marks, and he leaves without acknowledging the teaching, clearly not having had that profound transformation from the interaction that Kim has alluded to. So now, as narrator with Ananda's hat on.
Do you want to change your screen name, David?
Ah, thank you. Thank you, Diana. Indeed. So I'll do that again. And now, as narrator. Then Ambutta mounted his horse-drawn chariot and left. At that time, the Brahmin Pokarasati had come from Ukata together with a large group of Brahmins and was sitting in his own park, just waiting for Ambutta's return. Ambutta entered the park in his chariot, and he went as far by chariot as the terrain allowed, and then descended and approached his teacher, the Brahmin Pokarasati, on foot. He bowed and sat down to one side, and Pokarasati said to him,
"I hope, dear Ambutta, you saw the Master Gotama."
"I saw him, sir."
"Well, does he live up to his reputation or not?"
"He does, sir. Master Gotama possesses the 32 marks completely, lacking none."
"And did you have some discussion with him?"
"I did."
"And what kind of a discussion did you have with him?"
Then Ambutta informed Pokarasati of all that they had discussed.
"Oh, our bloody fake scholar, our fake learned man, who pretends to be proficient in the three Vedas. A man who behaves like this ought, when their body breaks up after death, to be reborn in a place of loss, a bad place, the underworld and hell. It's only because you repeatedly attack Master Gotama like that he kept on bringing up charges against us."
Angry and upset, Pokarasati shoved his student Ambutta over. Pokarasati then determined to see the Buddha for himself. Thus we say goodbye to Ambutta. Ambutta leaves the scene, leaves Digha Nikaya 3, and as far as we know, leaves the suttas. The next day, Pokarasati mounts a carriage and, together with his attendants carrying torches, set out from Ukata to in the forest near Inchanangala. He went by carriage as far as he could, as far as the terrain allowed, and then descended and entered the monastery on foot. He went up to the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side and spoke with the Buddha.
Master Gotama, has my student Ambata come here?
Yes, he has, Brahman.
And did you have some discussion with him?
I did.
And what kind of a discussion did you have with him?
And then the Buddha informed Pokarasati of all that they had discussed.
Ambata is a fool, Master Gotama. Please forgive him.
May the student Ambata be happy, Brahman.
Then Pokarasati scrutinized the Buddha's body for the 32 marks of a great man. He saw all except two, which he had doubts about, whether the private parts were covered in a sheath and the largeness of the tongue. Then the Buddha, using his psychic powers, willed that Pokarasati would see his private parts covered with a sheath. And he stuck out his tongue and stroked back and forth his ear holes and nostrils, covering his entire forehead with his tongue.
Pokarasati thought, the recluse Gotama possesses the 32 marks completely, lacking none. Would Master Gotama, together with the monastic Sangha, please come to my home and accept today's meal from me?
The Buddha consented with silence, and knowing that the Buddha had consented, Pokarasati said,
it's time, Master Gotama. The meal is ready.
Then the Buddha went to the home of Pokarasati together with his monastic Sangha, where he sat on the seat that was spread out for him. Pokarasati served the Buddha with his own hands a variety of delicious foods, while his students served the members of the Buddha Sangha. When the Buddha had eaten and washed his bowl, Pokarasati took a low seat and sat to one side.
Pokarasati, giving and ethical conduct are the foundation of the path. They are the basis for attaining rebirth in heaven up to the highest realms of Brahma. But even the refined pleasures of those realms are impermanent and subject to change. Attachment to them leads to states of woe. Renunciation is the superior way, bringing great benefits both here and hereafter.
At this time, the Buddha could see that Pokarasati's mind was ready, pliable, rid of hindrances, elated, confident, and so he continued with the teaching.
Listen closely. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, illness, death, wanting, not wanting, and all of the five aggregates of clinging are dukkha. The origin of dukkha is craving, delighting now here, now there, leading onward to rebirth. The relinquishment of this very craving is the cessation of dukkha. The path of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha is just this noble eightfold path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration, culminating in right knowledge and right release.
Just as a clean cloth rid of stains would properly absorb dye, in that very seat, the stainless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in the Brahman Pokarasati.
All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation.
Then Pokarasati saw, attained, understood, and fathomed the Dhamma. He went beyond doubt, got rid of indecision, and became self-assured and independent of others regarding the Buddha's instructions. So, quickly changing my name back to my given name and removing Ananda's hat. Let's reflect a little bit on this passage, which, as Kim set up in the guided meditation, provides a very special moment in which the Buddha, sensing that Pokharasati's mind is ready to receive the teaching of the Buddhas, provides that teaching. In contrast to the description of the path of practice received by Ambatta, Pokharasati is ready and receives the full teaching, and with it, and Pokharasati's Ying's use of lighting finds a moment, a view of the world that's free. So we can note a couple things. There's important setup. This doesn't happen all of a sudden, and it begins with the protocol and respect that we've talked about going along. Again, in contrast to Ambatta, and without Ambatta, there wouldn't be the contrast. It wouldn't be as clear to ourselves or other people in the audience, in the receiving of this story over millennia. But there's the protocol and respect. And in maybe something we don't see in the earlier exchange, something that's very significant here, is the provision or the providing of a meal. There's the meal offering. This is very important in these texts, and I would just remind you that it's important in human cultures throughout time. In graduate school, I had a professor of anthropology who said, no human ritual is complete. No human ritual of passage, of marriage, of death is complete until the meal has been offered and eaten. And we can see that here, that this sign of respect, this generous gesture on the part of Pokharasati, in a sense, marks an important passage that is happening for Pokharasati, perhaps for the larger community. Pokharasati sees the 32 marks right away. And he's maybe in a place where he can see them, unlike his student Ambatta. He doesn't have all the self in front of him that makes him offended and remembers previous interactions with the Sakyans. No, he goes immediately and sees, oh, this is the real deal, as I said Wednesday. This is a Buddha. This is an enlightened person walking free in the world, and he, knowing that, he's able to feel in himself the rising of confidence, or we might say faith, in the Buddha. So we see generosity and faith, and these are critical preconditions, if you will, or conditions for the readiness of his mind that the Buddha sees. The Buddha provides his teaching, I imagine, sort of checking. I don't know if Kim was doing it, but sort of watching Pokharasati. Pokharasati was pretty deep in meditation, and Kim, the Buddha, goes, okay, his mind is ready. His mind is ready to receive the teachings. And when he recognizes that his mind is ready, he provides that teaching. Many forms of this teaching, but in a sense, Ying then repeats it. Pokharasati repeats this teaching, that direct experience in meditation, in this case, of impermanence, of the unreliability of clinging to self, that seeing this, knowing this, frees. This is the second time we have a repeated passage. The Buddha says it, and then Pokharasati confirms it, right? Previously, we had the god Brahma, and then Buddha repeating this phrase. So this is a pairing, again, closing a story arc. This is another teaching that is said and then repeated in a confirming voice or affirming voice. So this is, again, sort of the climax of the action where Pokharasati, for all the reasons we've said, the conditions being right, receives the teaching of the Buddhas and comes to awakening. Ying.
Yeah, so thank you, David. So with that, we want to just open up for some time to share any comments, or if you have any questions, just a little time to take a pause and invite some reflections from you all.
And you can raise your hand or maybe put them in the chat box if you'd like.
Yep. So, Catherine.
Yes, I'm wondering if I have interpreted the use of the light and then the fade, it went away as Pokarasati experienced a glimpse of Nibbana but he's going to need more training or he's going to move ahead. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So David had go ahead.
Yeah, I think we could say it's more than a glimpse and possibly the light should have remained on. We could say that at this point, there's many phrases that describe this moment of transformation. But this is a point of stream entry. And the implication is that Pokarasati has entered the stream of practice and there's no turning back, that perhaps it will take some time. But the Pokarasati is now firmly in the path toward awakening or of awakening.
Yeah, and then you are right also, Catherine, that the training is not finished yet. So this is a moment that one knows this is the path. This will be the path. And one will just be carried by this training from this point on. And no one going to talk you out of it now. Yeah. Okay, any other comments and questions? I want to just also tie back to what Kim offered at the end of the meditation about this transformative moment, in small and big ways, and this particular one is a significant life-changing for Pokarasati. And so maybe, curious and that evoked something in you as well.
It might also be interesting to note that there's a sutta that says there are two qualities needed for stream entry, and they are wise attention and the voice of another. And we see both of those in this teaching. The mind has to be well directed, and then somehow we have to hear something from outside in order to wake up. It's an interesting to contemplate.
And then maybe I'll just add a few words to kind of like flesh out this moment. Pokarasati, right? He's a big cheese. That he has lots of students and he's like so powerful, right? The king has given him this town. It's like, okay, you can have this location that Ying showed us the first day. I loved this. But she said there was like hay and water and stuff like so this really favorable place. So for somebody as senior as Pokarasati to have this experience under the Buddha is really noteworthy. And the people would have understood that. People in the audience would have understood. I think this the implication there.
April.
Oh, I had a question. What specific moment or words was it that made you want to go see the Buddha yourself after talking to your student?
That's a great question. Yeah, so my sense in reflecting about what's being presented by this text is there is a very strong belief in the Brahmin tradition about the 32 marks. So when Pokarasati was sending Ambata to go check out what is being checked out is 32 marks. And Ambata came back and reported saying, oh yeah, I did see 32 marks. And so that probably perked an interest because there is a firm belief that seeing that indicates the Buddha is the great man. So that may be a significant piece that really brought him over.
And to that, I would add this. you know, there's action here that we didn't share the whole play or the whole sutta, not time enough for that. But we have the phrase, we know that Pokarasati asks the Buddha, did you have conversation with Ambatta? And then the Buddha says yes, and he describes the whole conversation. So in that whole conversation, parts of which you didn't hear, on two occasions at least, the Buddha tells Ambatta, oh Ambatta, see how your teacher has misled you? And this is reported when the Buddha repeats the conversation, Pokarasati, or when Ambatta tells Pokarasati of the conversation with the Buddha, Pokarasati will have heard this too, that the Buddha says, oh, Ambatta, your teacher has misled you. So there's also there sort of almost an invitation, actually, to go see the Buddha.
Yeah, and thank you, David, for pointing that out. And Diana, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Pokarasati says to the Buddha, please forgive my student. Right, so the Pokarasati kind of want to make some amends, wants to clean up this the strife or what's happened with Ambatta.
Yeah, potentially there is a kind of conflict effect here. You know, Pokarasati may also felt like they got attacked. You know, he needs to go see because the Master Gotama kind of had a lot of charges against us. And at the same time, also have this conflicting aspect of wanting to make amends after knowing this is, according to 32 marks, of being a great man. Yeah. So, Margaret.
Thank you. I'm reading the Ajahn Sujato's version of Sutta Central that you recommended. There's in the eighth section, what paragraph it is, it says the Buddha taught him, he's talking about Pokarasati, the Buddha taught him step by step with a talk on giving, ethical conduct, and heaven. So I wonder, could you explain that sentence? Is that the generosity and sila, and what would heaven be?
Yeah, so that part, since it's just summarized in the Sujato, because it's referring to an earlier, we filled that out with the dialogue that I read. And it's, you know, where I said giving and ethical conduct are the foundation of the path. They lead to rebirth in a higher rebirth all the way up to the highest realms of Brahma. That's what the Brahmins would care about. The Brahma realms are the highest heavens available. And then going beyond that, but, you know, even this is impermanent. And so we need to get off the round, not just aim for a higher rebirth. So we filled that out using kind of standard texts that's found in other parts of the suttas. This is has a name because the Buddha does this particular Dharma talk probably about a dozen times. I added up the times recently. It's about a dozen. And it's called the graduated discourse or the step-by-step teaching. That's what the Pali is closer to. Anyway, it's a standardized Dharma talk for somebody who is kind of ripe for the teachings. And the Buddha sees that. And so he starts from the very beginning of the path of dana, generosity, all the way up through the Four Noble Truths, the teaching that's special to his teaching. So you've asked about the key teaching. And that has the potential. That's the one that has the potential when the person is elated, confident, ready, etc., to transform their mind.
Thank you.
Jerry.
I'm going to take a chance here. I'm just trying this out. For Kim's question about a transformative moment, experientially, I am geared towards the delight or the enjoyment or the appreciation of transformative moments. So I agree on that. But I wonder if the phraseology is a little misleading, actually. So maybe a transformative threshold. In other words, there's no moment that is by itself. So if I only focus on a transformative moment, I've lost the perspective of the path or the process. So I would even say a transformative moment of the process, because at least for me, I may have a breakthrough, but within an hour or a week, I start to see, oh, remember that happened? And remember, I thought, oh, this makes perfect sense. So the awareness of a breakthrough, of a threshold being passed, is the process. And that reinforces us keeping on the path and doing the process. So,
very well said, Jerry. I don't feel like there's more to be added. Yes, it's a process and it's a conditioned process. Yeah.
And perhaps if we had more sophisticated technology instead of a flashlight illuminating Pokarasati / Ying, it would have been a glow or a representation. But yeah, you point to something important, Jerry, that I think indicates that, like the flashlight or like that, our minds have a hard time wrapping ourselves around this kind of transformative process. We want to see it as something distinct, something that we can hold, something we can make ours. And even there, we can get additionally caught.
But maybe I'll add on there. I think it's noteworthy what Pokarasati says after the flashlight goes on. I forget the exact words. All that arises is subject to decay. So what's being pointed to here is just this really deep, thorough understanding. Oh, there's nothing that to be held onto that can be a source of security, a source of lasting happiness. And in that moment of noticing, there's a letting go that just happens. And so that kind of really deep, but we also see this in not so deep, right? It's part of the process is to see more and more how all these things we're holding onto are not so helpful. But I think Pokarasati is pointing to, oh, there's nothing that can be held onto. And in fact, the Four Noble Truths, right, is talking about how, like, craving, this type of holding. And so the cessation of the craving is the way to freedom. So that's the way that I'm interpreting what is happening in that moment. So it's both true, what Jerry, exactly what you're saying. But there is some letting go and some insights that are happening all along the way.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for all of this.
We have one final reading that follows on this key passage that we've just discussed in some detail. And
excellent, Master Gotama, excellent. As if he were writing the overturned or revealing the hidden, or pointing out the path to the lost, or lightening a lamp in the dark so people with good eyes can see what's there. Just so has Master Gotama made the teaching clear in many ways. Together with my children, wives, retinue, and ministers, I go for refuge to Master Gotama, to the teaching and to the mendicant Sangha. From this day forth, may Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life. Just as Master Gotama visits other devoted families in Ukata, may he visit mine. The Brahmin boys and girls there will bow to you, rise in your presence, give you a seat and water, and gain confidence in their hearts. That will be for their lasting welfare and happiness.
And that's the end.
Nicely said, Pokarasati. So I'd like to just offer a few additional words to kind of help us step back. What can we say about this story now that we've seen the conclusion as this conclusion is the conversion of Pokarasati, right? A major Brahmin to the Buddha's teachings. And so it's, you know, if we had to put one single phrase, I guess this is a conversion story. But of course, it's so much more, right? But he becomes a lay follower for life. And we might feel a little bit uncomfortable with words like conversion, but that's what scholars call these texts. And these are fairly common, I think, among religious teachings, is that something like this comes about. But as we've seen in the class, conversion is not all that's going on. There were a lot of other layers going on. And one theme I'd like to draw forth now that we've seen the conclusion is this theme of teachers and students. So Pokarasati and the Buddha are both teachers, actually. Right. So, but we can notice that they're different. In particular, Pokarasati is from this long lineage of Brahmin teachers, and he memorized the three Vedas and, you know, did all the rituals correctly. And he believes that imparting these sacred verses are his main responsibility as a teacher. You know, if he's got students who have them all properly memorized and can do all the rituals, then he did his job as a teacher. And so we see him, and you know, what's his behavior? We see him giving Ambata this instruction to go and see the Buddha and look for the marks. And then when he returns, Pokarasati shoves him out of the way. It actually says kicks in the text. So he kicks him. So that's, I don't know, is that good behavior for a teacher? So, you know, there might be some unskillful mind states there, some ill will or anger or something. In contrast, we see the Buddha not losing his cool, you know, even when Ambata comes and insults him and insults his lineage and doesn't behave very well. He just takes that in stride, does this Aikido move on him, in fact. And he's also quite an engaged teacher. You know, he adjusts his style to meet the needs of the student and the needs of the moment. We see him being kind of flexible about that. So the Buddha seems to be a different style of teacher than Pokarasati. But Pokarasati has some complexity. As was mentioned, I think Diana mentioned it a few minutes ago, he was willing to be both a teacher and a student. So he had this kind of, you know, high good reputation and so forth. And yet he was willing to try to listen to the Buddha. Something in him had some faith in that. And he ended up actually seeing the marks and then getting something from this graduated discourse. He was able to have a direct experience from the Buddha's teaching in a way that Ambata didn't. So Pokarasati is has some complexity. At first, he tried to just send his student, and then later he went himself and actually was able to receive something. So in a way, he's almost the hero in the end, the one who had the biggest change. Ambata, of course, was the student the whole time, and he's very loyal to his teacher, always calls him sir, always bows, etc. But he had a hard time connecting with the Buddha. So he didn't have the flexibility, the maturity that some of the other characters did. But he is nonetheless enticed by the Buddha into asking, what are the knowledge and the conduct that you teach? He does ask a good question, and the Buddha gives him a full answer. And given his proclivity for memorizing things, he was said to be skilled in the three Vedas. He probably remembered what the Buddha said. So maybe that planted some seeds for him, and there's some hope there. And so we have, you know, we have an interesting reflection in this whole saga about, you know, how does a teacher behave? How does a student behave? What is possible in the teacher-student relationship? And what conditions have to be there for there to be some transmission from the teacher or not? Turns out there has to be something on both sides. So we can reflect on that in our various roles as student, and maybe some of us are teachers too, and how are we showing up with those conditions? Okay, and then finally, I would like to reiterate that this is, stepping back even farther, this is oral literature. It has a long history in cultures throughout the world, certainly is not unique to this tradition. It's worth saying that in ancient India, the oral tradition had been developing for centuries before the Buddha. So the oldest of the Vedas, which are what, you know, these things that the Brahmins memorized, predated the Buddha by at least 800 years. So this is the cultural technology, shall we say, of preserving teachings through memorization was firmly in place already. The Buddha was just stepping into that. The scholar Sarah Shaw wrote this interesting book called The Art of Listening, which is about the oral tradition of the Digha Nikaya in particular, but it also talks more generally. And now that we've experienced this performance in DN3, we can kind of step back to the bigger picture of this. So I want to read from a couple quotes from the book. So she says, "People would have heard Buddhist canonical texts as living performances. Listeners would not have been solitary, but sitting with others and enjoying the occasion. Some might have been snoozing or there under sufferance of parental authority. Others might actually have meditated during the recitation or listened attentively and made the listening a kind of practice." So, you know, these are definitely great dramatic stories. We're there for the performance in a sense, but is that the only purpose? So then I'll read again from Sarah Shaw. "The intentions of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, they're not literary, philosophical, theological, or always logically analytical. From the Buddhist perspective, the very act of listening to, reciting, or memorizing texts is a form of bhavana, practice intended to arouse the factors of the Eightfold Path in the listener. While Buddhist texts draw on features of bardic songs, stories, and poems, they are different from many forms of oral literature in that they aim to communicate a complete path to awakening. The intention of a Buddhist text must, in the end, be to wake up." And that's what we saw. So I also found this quote from the Anguttara Nikaya from another part of the suttas. It says, "There is a time for listening, a time for talking, a time for calm, and a time for insight." I think it's very sweet, so we might consider that. So thank you. I'll pass it on to Diana.
Thank you, Kim. And I also want to say thank you, Ying, for your going for refuge to the Buddha. I like felt that. I felt like your kind of like devotion or something. It was beautiful. So thank you very much. I loved that. I loved that. So I'm just going to build a little bit on what Kim was saying. But one thing I want to point out is that we have this experience ourselves, this idea of debates or people talking to each other. We might say we have presidential debates in this country, right? So this idea. But I also want to point out in 1873, there was a debate that occurred in Sri Lanka, which was under colonial rule, between the Buddhist monks and Christian missionaries. And there was generally decided that the Buddhists won this debate. And part of the reason is because they had been educated by the Christians. They'd gone to schools that were run by Christians. So they knew the Christian faith very well, and they knew their own. But importantly, there was a 10-year-old boy who attended this debate. He later changed his name to Anagarika Dharmapala. And he was instrumental and kind of doing this Buddhist revivalism in Sri Lanka and bringing Buddhism to the West, kind of like starting this, we might say Buddhist modernism, which kind of emphasized the rational thought that we see in Buddhism and the importance of the laity and kind of de-emphasizing the supernatural objects. So this is how the Buddhism that we here in America are, or I should say the Theravada Buddhism here in America, really kind of extends from this debate that happened, you know, in Sri Lanka in the late 1800s. So I want to kind of like make this real and impactful for us. But also, so that's a little bit about the format, but also to build on what Kim was saying, right, we get impacted by what we hear, just like that 10-year-old boy in Sri Lanka later became a really important figure. But we maybe when we hear these stories, we can recognize, oh, we have a little bit of each of these character in ourselves. Maybe we're like Pokarasati sometimes, where we're open to new ideas and we get transformed when we hear things. But maybe sometimes we're also impatient with other people. Maybe we don't shove them over, but, or maybe we're like the narrator sometimes, where like observing, describing what's happening, but not getting involved. Or maybe sometimes we're like Ambetta, who wants to please his teacher, but he also wants to be seen a particular way. And he wants to be treated a particular way and reluctant to change his thinking, even in the presence of the Buddha, right? An enlightened person. And sometimes maybe we're like the Buddha, very wise, equanimous, compassionate, really dedicated his entire life, after his awakening, to serve and support others. He's generous with his time, even though he's like being insulted. Or maybe it's the teachings themselves that don't have an impact necessarily on Ambetta, but definitely have an impact on Pokarasati. So just this idea that all that we're hearing, right? It's a nice story and we pulled this together in a particular way, but there's a way in which we can make it relevant for ourselves. We can bring it into our own lives and interact with it in a particular way or make it our own in some particular way. And maybe with that, I'll turn it over to David.
You caught me unawares there, but I've I've recovered. So yeah, now we'd like to go to some breakout rooms and maybe encourage you to sort of connect with one another around the themes that both Kim and Diana have just brought forward, which maybe we could summarize in a sense by bringing, as we sort of move toward the end of this three-class exploration of Digha Nikaya 3, sort of how we might incorporate this kind of exploration and this particular text into our practice, into our lives, into our practice lives. So we have a couple questions, and maybe we'll provide one kind of halfway through this roughly 12-minute breakout discussion session. The first one is just sort of, how does this exploration landing as it does now, kind of considering maybe some of the impact on this reading in these last 3 days, how does this support your practice? So why don't we begin with that? And as we've said before, you know, you maybe go around in a circle, kind of the spiral thing where you just, you know, add one, contribute one thing, and then see how that bounces around to others. We began once before in alphabetical order. Why don't we go this time in reverse alphabetical order? I don't know. That mixes it up slightly. And so we'll spend about 5 or 6 minutes talking about that. Just kind of how does this land in your practice? How might it support your practice? And then we'll give you another question about halfway through. So enjoy.
right, welcome back. Give a few moments for everyone to come back. Okay, I think this is it. This is everybody came back to the big group. So we have another few moments to debrief or offer opportunities to share any comments and reflections or questions. I will also offer that we have a prompt for you. And that is, what's the impact of this story on you? And it's optional. Anything that's up for you based on what you heard so far and your engagement with the group's discussions are welcome. And so open it up. And feel free to put anything in the chat box also, if you like to do that. Oh, okay. So April, go ahead. I see your hand up.
Yeah, so the reason I was looking forward to this three-part series, drama theater, was I was hoping to get the nonverbal communication, tone of voice, facial expressions, the emotions of the sutras to help me in my optimistic political discussions. And the first week, when Buddha dismisses that student, I thought, oh, great. Okay, I got that. But then it's sad because he turns out to be kind of hopeless, because it's only the enlightened one, the Brahmin priest, that can really get it. So now I'm back to being hopeless.
Well, not quite. Remember that towards the end, the Pukrasati actually saying that his children, wives, the ministers, you know, the whole gang joins the Buddha, taking the Buddha and Dhamma and Sangha for refuge. So I wouldn't just say it's a hopeless. I think it's an evolving current, and Pukrasati being who he is in the Brahmin tradition does have a strong influence. So, yeah. Diana.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. I don't need to add anything more.
Will.
Yeah, a question I have is about, what do you understand refuge to have meant in those times? Was it a pre-existing thing before? For other groups as well as for Buddhism, because Pukrasati took refuge, and Ajatasattu, a king who had killed his father, took refuge. So what would that mean to them? What would that imply? If you can help with that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, great question. I'm going to invite any of my co-teachers want to say anything.
Maybe I'll just say a few words and then some of my co-teachers can jump in there. I think going for refuge is a way that you say, like, okay, I'm going to orient my way, my life this way. Remember, Pukrasati says he's going to be a lay follower. So he's not ordaining, but he's just saying, okay, actually, I'm going to recognize the Buddha as a teacher and going to pay respect to the monastics of the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha. So I think that's what it is, just kind of an orientation. But there is a type of refuge, you know, which people kind of ordain. And then maybe the second thing I'll say is, it's interesting that the Buddha never asks people to go for refuge. It just comes out, they do it voluntarily, comes out of their, because appreciation, or Pukrasati, right, had this transformative experience. So it's a way of saying, like, wow, okay, now I see things differently, and I'm going to orient my life this direction.
So. Yeah, I'm following exactly on what Diana says. I would say that I think refuge can have different meanings, and I think it's a idea that can have a multitude of meanings, and that can be a nice way to settle into it. I would say there's also a sense in which it's going for protection, that refuge is experienced as a place of protection. And I like the idea that although the phrase is technically going for refuge, that there's a way in which the teachings provide refuge, and there's an understanding or an acknowledgement of the refuge that's there in the teachings. So there's a sense of I'm going to the Master Gotama. That's just how we have to express it in language. But there's also a sense in which we can hear Pokarasati, understanding the transformative process he's in, of recognizing that he is in these teachings. He has entered the stream of practice, and that he is recognizing that refuge. As I think Ying said earlier, there's no going back at this point. So he's doing what comes naturally as a part of his evolving practice.
Yeah, I'll say maybe from the perspective, almost like a lineage perspective that the Brahmins are familiar with, this for Pokarasati, it almost feels like a shift and change of a lineage, you know, when taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, or shifting, reorienting myself towards this. Yeah. And so it can be for Pokarasati, is absolutely very significant. It is a life-changing event. Yeah. Leanne.
First, thank you so much for doing the dramatization of this passage. And I think you were wise to do it. It was well done and really brought the sutras to life. And I could feel a lot more involved than had I just read it. So, and then I wanted to confess that I felt more in tune with Ambata than Pokarasati because of where I feel like I'm at in my life. And I aspire to Pokarasati, but I see that there are things and, you know, hindrances in my mind that hold me back from being able to really commit to a life of Buddhism and following the Buddha and his teachings. And so I feel like I, you know, would like to spend more reflection on what those hindrances are, what prevents me, holds me back. And from completely taking refuge and how I could move forward and leave those kind of things behind, get past them. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, deep bows to you, Leanne. This is a part of the path, right? We recognize the challenges. We recognize, oh, I have lots of questions, doubts, and we work with it. And that's part of the path. That's really part of the path. And so deep bowing, a lot of respect for that inner reflection. Yeah.
And I would add, and thank you for sharing, Leanne. I think, you know, we all find ourselves, like Diana said, in these roles. And maybe recall to the Buddha's words in Kim's voice, may the student Ambata be happy, Brahman. So may you be happy. That's the Buddha's perspective. No upset, just may you be well.
Yeah. Margaret.
Yeah, I'd like to ask David, I think you said refuges provide, give us protection. Can you explain that a little bit further, what you mean by protection, please? Thank you.
Probably not. I think that's a personal feeling. That for me, there's protection in this view of the world, in this view of the way things arise and pass. To me, it feels like a protective thing and almost a protective gesture. Part of that's too drawn on the sense that we're dealing here in this realm of aristocrats and Brahmins, and there is a way in which any aristocratic noble person protects the people that depend on him or her. And so I'm kind of invoking that too, that there is that sense of looking to this figure and the Sangha as a sort of a protective sphere. But again, that's it's a deeply personal thing, and it's sort of maybe my take on how it feels in my practice.
I invite you to
do the same. Sort of, how does it feel for you when you feel that sense of connection with the teachings? And I feel a sense of safety there.
Thank you all.
Okay. I would like to add one thing to that, which is that it's sometimes people see refuge as something extra, like, oh, I'm taking something on. But actually, we have already all taken refuge. You know, living as a human, we have things that we consider that we rely on as people. And what we usually rely on are our relationships, our job, our health, our community, you know, the things around us. And there's a way in which that's very normal and fine. And the lesson of the Dharma as we start to get more mindful is that these things are not as reliable as they look. And that's what Pokhara-Sati understands. Everything that arises will cease. And sometimes they cease before we want them to. And so then the mind casts about what is reliable. And the first thing offered is Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. You know, those are more reliable refuges than what we've all taken refuge. So this is a better option. And then eventually, you know, we may have the transformation that Pokhara-Sati did and understand for ourselves the truth of what the Buddha was teaching that is completely reliable. But this is an interim. So that's another way to think of it. And we can feel it, as David says.
Thank you, Kim. That's very helpful. Thank you.
So, Diana.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I feel a little bit, sad maybe is not the right word, but this has been so much fun, Kim, Ying, David, Giona. Just thank you. Thank you that we kind of pulled this together. I want to say thank you to my co-conspirators here. And thank you to you guys, right, for listening, participating, asking questions, right? If there isn't an audience, there's no performers or something like this, if we dare call ourselves performers. We're kind of like teachers. But I don't know, I just want to deep bow to you guys. Thank you for joining us on this journey. And so I'll also talk about a few questions that people ask at the end of our classes. Some of you may know that this, I think we've done like more than a dozen classes. This is the first time I've put my hair up in a top knot and we did these types of teachings. But there's often the question, well, when are you going to do it again? Or what are you going to do? We don't have any specific dates right now. We definitely are going to be doing some more teaching. We teach in different modes. This is our first time we're doing it like this. We may explore whether we want to do it again. This was kind of like experimental. So to see how you guys responded. So no promises on what we will be doing. But if you'd like to know what we're doing, the Sati Center has a newsletter. It's called a newsletter that goes out when there are new offerings. So if you wanted to sign up for that, you'll be notified when not only what we are doing, but what other people are doing. So that's one way to keep informed of when the four of us are going to be doing something again. We also at the end also often get a question, well, how can we donate? How can we help support the Sati Center and support us teachers? And I'm putting in the chat box a link that is unique to this event. So we've done some coding behind the scenes. So this link will kind of like earmark donations for this event. You're not required to donate, but if you feel inspired or you feel motivated, touched, or something like this, it's a way to kind of like help keep the Sati Center going and these types of things, offerings going. And then maybe one more link that I'll put in, I saw this kind of go whiz by in the chat box earlier, is, where are these audio recordings? These were recorded and they're already posted for class one and class two. There we go. Here's the link where you can find them. And soon we will add the audio recording from today. So the video recording is not up. The audio recording is of just the whole class. And we'll see when we do some editing how this looks and whether it'll go up as a video by just like the dramatization by itself, or I don't know, we'll play around with what we have here and see what the next steps are. And maybe I'll just say the last thing for regarding the recording. It's under a series in Audio Dharma. So for those of you who are familiar with Audio Dharma, you know about a series. Wow, that was a lot of information. I just, again, want to end with some heartfelt appreciation of my co-teachers and you guys for going on this journey with us and kind of this new fun way of connecting with, exploring, sharing the Dharma. And I'd invite my co-teachers here to unmute. Maybe you have a word or two you'd like to say before we end here.
I'm conscious that there was a question from Dimitra about Pokrosati. Yeah, Pokrosati doesn't show up that often in the sutta, so we don't quite know. But for stream entries, it's known that they will awaken someday.
That's right. And there was in the chat box a question about the Sri Lankan events. And if you're interested in this, one way to kind of enter into the information is to Google the name of the person, is Anagarika Dharmapala, if you're interested in this stuff. Anagarika.
Yeah. And I'll just say thank you in the same vein as my other co-teachers. It's wonderful. And we'll let David do the final offering.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank you all for joining us in this exploration. Perhaps, you know, you can have a play with just players and no audience or community. But we are at IMC and the Sati Center and the four of us, we're a practice community. We practice together. We support one another's practice and really appreciate people being here for that. One of the aspects of protocol, perhaps a showing of respect to the Dhamma, is to dedicate the merit of our practice together in community over these last few days. And just what comes to the fore for me, no, haven't thought out any words, is just to say, let's take what we learned by this particular way of exploring these texts that come to us as texts, but recognizing how much broader they are than written documents, that they have this long oral tradition behind them that really can open our hearts, affect our hearts, put us in touch with the real people who have walked this path of practice, the Ambattas, the Pokrosatis, the Buddhas, and by connecting with them, connect with others, sharing the benefits of the practice together. May all beings know this path of practice. May all beings understand suffering deeply. May all beings be open to the teaching of the Buddhas when it's offered. May all beings be free. Thank you all, and feel free to unmute if you want to say farewell. Take care until our paths cross again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot.
Bye, everyone.
Heartfelt thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.